This is Cheryl McQuaid with the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. We're at the Lansing Car Assembly Plant in the the Engineering Conference Room. It's October 17th, 2005. We're preparing to interview Doug Gross. Could you state your name, Doug, and the spelling of your last name and your address, please?
Yes, my name is Doug Gross, and it's spelled G-R-O-S-S. And I live at 11874 West Cutler Road, Eagle, Michigan, 48822.
We'd also like to take a moment to let everybody else in the room state their name.
Doreen Howard.
Doug Rademacher.
John Vila.
Marilyn Coulter.
Linda Johnson.
Mike Fleming.
Doug, we would like to know the date you hired into this plant. And maybe a little bit about the first day that you hired in.
Okay, I hired in March 25th of 1981. And I remember I came in and I worked across the line from a guy named Vern. And Vern was a very, he was kind of an older gentleman. And he was pretty negative. Of course, at that time, they were getting ready to put on two shifts. So the guy that was breaking me in, his name was he was an Italian guy, Luigi or something like that. And then Tim Ferris was going to be my partner on afternoon shift. And it was quite an interesting first day learning the wagons and the brakes. And they told me to go down to the hospital, and I got lost for like 3.5 hours. I had no idea where I was. And I got back, and everybody was laughing at me. Vern was tripping on me, going, yeah, you're just one of those, you know, low-life young kids come in, you know, and he was giving me a hard time about getting lost. But honestly, I got lost, and, you know, so I learned to look at column numbers really quick.
What was wagons in Oh, your brakes, talk about that.
Well, wagons was, of course, when they came around and they had the little cart, and they would sell, what I bought almost every day was the honey buns and the orange drink, because I really liked those. The orange drinks come in a carton, and I really liked the orange drinks. They were good. The fruit punch wasn't that good. It kind of had like a funny aftertaste to it, so I didn't like those. So. But and then the pop machines were the plastic cup would drop down, and then ice would come into it, and then the syrup would come, and then the fizzly stuff would come after that. So, and of course you'd buy a Pepsi and you'd put peanuts in there. It was really good.
What brought you to come to Fisher Body to actually hire in here?
Well, in 1979, my general business teacher, Mr. Ludwig, had us, myself and John Fedewa, do a project. And the project was to either do a resume or a letter of application. And both John and I did the letter of application to General Motors. I don't even think that we had heard that they were hiring at the time, to tell you the truth, but we thought that, you know, we'd put it in there. And so John and I skipped school one day to come over and try and get an interview. And we got the interview, and John got hired in 79, and I didn't. You know, he obviously spent more time in the confessional than I did at that period in time of our lives. So at any rate, then in 1981, from 79 to 81, I had called a lady in the personnel department. Her name was Donna, and I called her, I believe it was every Tuesday at between 9 and 10. And it just got to be after, you know, a couple of years, she just knew that it was me, you know, and she's like, nope, Doug, you know, we're not hiring yet. And then I heard that they were hiring. And I had called her like 2 weeks before or a week before, and she hadn't said anything that they were thinking about hiring or anything. And so I was standing out in the line, and the line went from the south gate, and it zigzagged like a snake 4 or 5 times before I got there at like 6 o'clock in the morning. And And so I got to be about, I don't know, 8:30 or 9 o'clock, and I told, you know, the people who was in front of me and in back of me, hey, I'm going to go over and use the phone, because we were all, you know, we would run over to the store and get a pop or whatever, and we'd hold our place in line. And I told them, you know, if I'm not back in, like, you know, 20, 30 minutes, just go ahead, you know, you guys can have my place in line. And they said, all right. And I went over and called, and Donna said, yeah, come on in. So she said, just walk by everybody. And so I went from over by Safeway at the... where the telephone was, and I walked around to the front of the building, and I walked by a bunch of people I know, right? You know, my cousins and stuff, and I walked right by them and went up in, and they put me to work the next day. So it was pretty neat.
How many people do you think were standing in that line?
Thousands.
Wow.
I mean, there were a lot of people there. You know, and it was kind of like a single file, double file line, you know, and it had... By the time I got there at 6 a.m., it was a long line. It came out of the doors, and then it went like through that little close parking lot, and then once it hit the big parking lot, it zigzagged probably a good 4 or 5 times, and then there were people at the front gate too.
Doug, that is an interesting story. Tell me, what was like to walk past everybody and to go down into the front corridor where they were accepting applications and not be in line? Well, that must have been a very odd feeling. And
yeah, you know, because, you know, my cousin Jim looked at me and he's like, well, where are you going? I'm like, in there. You know, I mean, I was just excited, you know, I mean, that she had said, yeah, come on in, you know, just walk by everybody. And I'm just, once I got to the security guards, you know, they're like looking at me like, hold it, what are you doing? I'm like, well, Donna said, and they're like, oh, you're Doug. And I'm like, yep. And, you know, she had already called down to security to tell them to let me in. So,
Doug, what made you be so persistent for so many years to get in?
Money. Money, and that's where, you know, I mean, I have quite a lineage in here, not with my mom and dad, but like my Uncle Leon worked here. He's retired now. My Uncle Dick, my Uncle Larry, my Aunt Karen, my Aunt Loretta, and then, of course, my cousin Jeff. He hired in '79 with John, and then me and, myself and Jim Felposh hired in '81, and then Scott hired in, I think, in '84, and then Ed, and, I mean, there's just a lot of people.
So because you had so many family members who worked here, what were some of the things growing up that you heard about this place, outside of the money, of course?
Well, money, benefits. You know, I was I hung around a lot with, of course, with the family and everything, and they just always made a good living. You know, it was just like they were always comfortable, as we were. I mean, my dad, of course, owned his own shop in Portland, but you know, well, at the time that was in Charlotte, but you know, they always made a good living, and they didn't really complain ever about the work. I never heard them ever complain that the work was like way, way, way too hard, or that, you know, work was a drag. You never heard that coming from them, you know. And then, of course, I had on the growth side, all of those guys worked at the Oldsmobile plant, and so, you know, I had sent both when John and I did the project, I had sent them to both to 652, well, what was it called, Oldsmobile, and here, and I had gotten a physical and an orientation at both places, but again, in 79, they had just stopped hiring just short of me. It was like, here I've got, you know, I'm like, it's in my hands. I've got the orientation, the safety glasses, the physical, everything, and then they're going, we'll call you, and, you know, and it's like the call never came, so...
That first day must have been just ecstatic for you too.
Yeah, it was. It was really cool, you know. And of course, Tim and I are still really, really good friends. You know, we've had a lot of people, you know, come and go. You know, I mean, as far as like when they started offering buyouts and stuff like that. You know, a couple of my good friends took the buyout. You know, which you know, they're doing very well now. You know, they're doing really, really good, you know. So, I mean, life does go on beyond Fisher Body, you know, but you know, it's all about attitude and what you do. So,
can you explain black buyout for those people who don't know what buyout means, please?
Yeah, a buyout is when they would give you like $35,000, and then you would just basically give up your job. They would give you a chunk of money, and then, you know, you more or less, they just bought you out, so they just erased your Social Security number from GM.
When you first came in, can you explain the first job that they put you on, and what department, and what shift?
Sure. Well, when the first day I came in, of course, we knew that we were being hired for the second shift. It was down on what was called the A system at that time, which of course now is called was called the C system, and we were building the Cutlasses, Cutlass Supreme, two doors, four doors, and wagons, and I did the retractor house bolt down and the CO9 tuck vinyl ring that went along the back window of the car. And I had to put in six rivets around the back window. And then we built up our own retractor houses. And you had to put deadener patches and sealer in each of the corners. And then you put foam that would stop it from rattling along the curved end. And then you had to just reach into the car and slide the slot up in and put it down. And then the next people down the line put in eight screws around there and then one major bolt. And then two jobs down the line, they bolted in the actual retractor that retracted the seatbelt back inside there.
So what did you think of that job? Did you think it was hard?
It was a cat's meow compared to what, you know, I had did in the past. I was pouring concrete, and if anybody's ever poured concrete, that's a... You know, we'd pull concrete into forms, you know, that were about waist high. It was actually they made hot tanks, you know, and they would pour a base, and it would be like as big as a football field over the top, you know. Then they'd build a pole barn over the top. And so we did all the solid forms and then the slatted forms. So
compared to what the physical labor that you were doing prior to that, this was a good job?
It was a great job. You know, the only thing that I found difficult was that I was tied in one place and couldn't go any place unless somebody came and took my place. Where at the other plant, if you had to go to the bathroom, you would just say, "Hey, I'm going to the bathroom," and somebody would just jump up and take your place and, you know, fill in the person driving the fork truck. You could go to the bathroom and come back and then take the puller back and go right back to work.
Now, as time went on, did you still have the same attitude toward the jobs that you did? Did you find that they were still physically easy, or was there ever any time where you started to have problems at all with any of the jobs?
No, physically, no. We sat windshields. After I did the retractor house bolt down, I went over and started running the windshields. And so there was a three-man team, and then one person rotated. So you had the three tables that built the glass. One person got the glass, and then one person was on break. Okay, so the person who was getting the glass was on the first table, and then we rotated between the three tables. And that was with Gail Crandall, Dennis Pelton, myself, and there, let me see, 1, 2, 3, and then there was four, Paul, I can't remember Paulie's last name, Paul Denny, and we ran those windshields. And like I said, you know, that was probably the most physical job that I ever had, because you actually had to pick up the windshield and, you know, with the suction cups, and then walk across the line and put in a piece of permagum on the side. So, but we had a lot of fun down there. We really did. We turned the table, went from 1 to 10, And when you least expected, whoever was doing glass, if they put the table on 10, it was flying, man. The glass would almost take off. It looked like a helicopter, right? You know? And you would go, whoa! And then, you know, because it was, I mean, you had to stay in sync with everybody else. If not, the process was, it was a nightmare because, you know, then you'd have to run up the line. The next job up the line, they paddled the windshield, paddled the urethane in to tuck it into the glass, and then the next one was the reveal molding. And if you got by the reveal molding, then everybody was shipping their stuff. And of course, then the, you know, can call guy at that time, that's what we called him, who would give the can calls or pick up the stuff down the line. He was just screaming. He would get so mad at us because we were constantly messing around. I mean, there wasn't a day that didn't go by that we were down the line.
You started to touch base a little bit on some of the pranks and things that you did. You talked a little bit about going to the hospital and getting lost and things like that, and other turning up the speed on the glass. What's some of the other things that you guys did for fun? Yeah.
Well, what I would do specifically is, you know, Dennis Pelton and I had a love-hate relationship. You know, we really, really liked each other. We're still really, really good friends. You know, I talk to him all the time out at the job bank and stuff. But what I would do is I would take a zip strip, a plastic, long piece of plastic, and I would get some urethane, and I would put it all the way up into the top of the glove of his middle finger. Now, urethane, unless you had special hand cleaner, you couldn't get it off you. It was a nightmare in the primer, too. It was terrible. And so in between, like I said, every 20 minutes, and in 20 minutes, his whole hand would turn black, and he wouldn't even know it, you know, and he'd pull off his glove and go, "Okay!" Scream, and, you know, of course, then he'd chase me around with his hand trying to touch me and stuff, and we'd be laughing, and then we'd get all down the line, and then he'd go to break, and then we'd spend his whole break getting back up the line. You know, it was... You know, or, you know, but, yeah, we did that, and...
Why did you do that?
Huh?
Why did you do that?
Well, because I liked him. That, and I would always steal his cigarettes, because I was, when I was quitting cigarettes, I was trying to quit when I hired in, and I would always bum cigarettes, and it would drive him nuts. Why don't you just buy your own pack? I'm like, well, because you're buying them, you know, I don't have to. And so I was constantly, I would either bum him or I would just grab his pack, because we had these little trays that we would set our personal stuff on. And I would just take one, you know, from him. And, of course, he'd get all mad at me and everything. And then so for one Christmas, I bought him 4 cartons of cigarettes and had his wife wrap them for me and put them underneath the tree, you know, kind of like a Santa Claus thing. And he came in. He was just touched that I would even buy him something, let alone, you know. And I think really that was the start of when Dennis and I actually really started to like each other.
You know.
You started to touch base on some of the camaraderie. Do you have other friends in the plant that you do things either in the plant or outside of the plant with at this time?
Roy Fidwa and myself, we'll go fishing from time to time. The people that you work around is basically, you know, they turn into your family, you know. And when I worked up in Polish, was probably, you know, besides windshields, was probably the closest I've ever been to a group of guys. Rich Smith, Brent Moore, Rob Haney, who else was up there? Doug Scott. There was just a bunch of us up there. And, those guys were probably the biggest influence on me because, of course, at that point, you know, all those guys were Christians, and you had, you know, lonely Doug up there, you know, who was running to the bar, you know, every lunch hour. And so, you know, those guys were really, you know, the reason why I really started to, you know, believe as strongly as I do. So, and then, of course, shortly after that, then, you know, about 3 years after that, I started Bible college, and, you know, then getting into Bible college, you know, I went through all of that and got put in a sent ministry, and then I got ordained. Well, first I was licensed, then I got my ordination, and then this job came open, and I was already an alternate in the employees assistance work family office. And so I just moved right into this position as the chaplain.
Before we go to chaplain, and you talked about it, what were some of the things that those groups of men who were Christian men, what were some of the types of things that they did on their downtime that drew you in to the faith?
Well, it wasn't really like, you know, this huge religious Bible study thing. You know, it was more like a camaraderie of, you know, we're all in this together. It was like a teamwork thing. It was like, you know, we would have all kinds of, I want to say cookouts, but cooking. You know, people would bring in their favorite dishes, and we would set it down on a picnic table. We had parties, and Rich and I drank hot chocolate. We had this hot chocolate thing going on with the marshmallows, and, you know, I had a little hot coffee pot that I did the hot water in, and then, you know, everybody just, like I said, you know, it was like a, for a season there, it was just like a Thanksgiving every day.
Every day.
I gained a lot of weight.
Now, I know, like in certain areas, though, they do have Bible studies on the floor. And did you find that there were very many of those, and were they well received?
I've known, when I worked in paint, we had one. There was a bunch of sanitation guys and a bunch of people from paint. Because there's so many staggered times in paint, it was like a moving Bible study that lasted about an hour and a half with the same people in it. Don Loomis in Glenn Babb were the ones that pretty much, you know, took control of the meeting. Not, I don't want to say control. They more or less had the devotion, the scripture picked out for the day, and then we would talk about that specific scripture. Now, the best, and of course, we would bring in our guitars, and we would play bluegrass music, and Lyle would break out his harmonica, and, you know, I mean, we just really, you know, had a good time. You know, we really did. The best one I ever went through, I mean, as far as teaching-wise, was one that was in the Labor Relations Conference Room on the afternoon shift. Ray Jackson ran that one. And it was just a really, really nice Bible study. You know, down-to-earth teaching. You know, stuff that you could use every day. You know, help you with your spiritual growth. You know, and it really, you know, I look forward to it. You know, so every day at lunch, I mean, you always had some place to go and people to commune with, you know. So.
Now you talked about when you started out, you started in trim.
Mm-hmm.
And then you talked about polishing.
Right.
Where was that at?
Well, in 19, let me see, what year was it? It would have had to have been 19, that long changeover, 1984, I believe. Between 83 and 84, they had quite a long changeover there. And at that point, I leveled off up into paint. And they said, you know, when they took us up there, when we leveled off, they said, you know, who likes overtime? And I raised my hand, so they put me up in Building 21-3, which was off of repair. So the cars would come up out of the main color booth. They would either get bought. If they got bought, they came onto our line. They got the deadener, the elephant ears, and they were sanded, the little defects. And then they went into the polish booths. The sides was first. And then it came around to our side, and then we did the roofs, tops, and the deck lids because we were up in the air, up on a ramp in a booth. And probably one of the most funniest things that I've ever seen in my life was Wilbur. He was a black guy, and Wilbur was just a super, super guy, you know, always wanting to help people and everything. And he was up there. And he was polishing, and he had the cord wrapped up underneath his arm, and then he had the polish wheel, you know, the cord came up over the top of his shoulder. And I told him, I'm like, Wilbur, dude, man, you know, you need to take that cord off your shoulder, you know. And he's like, going, oh, no, no, man, I'll never hit it, it's in back of me. And I'm going, dude, I'm telling you, that cord is going to, if you touch that cord, it's going to wrap up. I said, and it's not going to be pretty. And he's like going, oh, man, I got it. I'm like, okay, you know, I never wanted to push people to do something they didn't want to do, and it wasn't two jobs later, man, and that polish wheel went wow, right up.
Ow.
He was all tied up in that polish wheel. You know, we had to shut the line down because he couldn't, I mean, it was so tight, and up underneath his chin, he couldn't put his chin down to see to try and get the cord off. It was just hilarious. I'm like, well, dude, man, we went down there, and, you know, of course, like I said, you know, first thing I did was unplugged it, and then me and Rich and Brent helped him get untangled from the cord. But he didn't get hurt at all. He got, you know, scratched up a little bit. The polished wheel, it kind of scratched up his arm, you know, but other than that, he was all right.
Now, the 21-3, you said this?
Yes.
Now, describe where that is in location to the other parts of the plant, and was there a lot of people up there, and was it as far as proximity and closeness to other areas?
Building 21 was probably the closest thing to heaven you would ever get, because it was way up in the air, and if you didn't get the elevator, you were going to be sweating when you got to the top of those stairs. There was a stairwell over, it would be, let me see, the west side of the plant. In the stairwell, I believe there was, I'm going to say, 700, 800 steps in the whole stairwell. It was unbelievable. Seven steps per flight, and there was, had to have been 15 to 20 flights in that stairway. And but Building 23, you had all of the mainline buyers, the repair buyers, because the cars would be set on repair. They would go downstairs into repair. They would be fixed, come back up through the oven, and then they would come upstairs, and then you would have the buyers who took off all the plastic and everything. And then those two lines fed our FF line, which was the finesse line. And then the first job was the elephant ear job. Then it would go into the blackout job, where they would spray blackout paint, which would be right in front of where the radiator would sit. They would spray blackout up there, and then it would come into the deadener booth. And then once it got into deadener, of course, I worked in deadener too, once it got into deadener, they would spray deadener inside both the fender wells, and it would go out of there, and then it would be the side polishers and the side cleanup, and then it went around to the first job in the booth. So there was probably maybe 60 or 70 people at one time. I think that would have been about the most that worked up there at that time. They had two intermittent relief guys. Jerry and Dennis Pelton ended up following me up to paint. And so for a while, when I worked in the deadener booth, he was my first-time build coordinator, and that would have been the second gift I bought him, because he would come in and he would stand in one spot, and me and Jeff Hunter would work opposite of each other. So when he was starting a job, I was finishing a job. When I was starting a job, he was finishing a job. So we never sprayed each other. And so Dennis would come in, and he would stand all the way up there, and I would come up the line, and I would just spray him with deadener, and he'd go, "Okay," every time I hit him. So like, if he was in there for 15 minutes every other minute, you'd hear, "Okay." So I'd spray his socks, and his white socks, because he always wore shorts, his white socks would end up black. So for Christmas every year, I would buy him a package of six pairs of socks.
Doug, you said you worked in trim, and then you went to polish.
Yep.
You said you leveled off to get there. Would you explain what level off means?
Leveling off is basically when the whole plant goes down. They bring them back by seniority per department. If you level off, I believe in the first 3 days, then you will be put in a list to be in seniority when your seniority comes up plant wide. So if you level off in the first 3 days, or you have or on the 89th day. Now, you can wait until you come back per job in your department. So, like, if I would have stayed out, I probably would have stayed out for another 3 or 4 weeks before trim was populated again. So, being that they were populating, first they would populate body shop, then they would populate paint, then they populate trim. So, I was in trim at that time. I leveled off, which in the first 3 days, so I leveled off as soon as I went out. And as soon as my seniority came up, now if my seniority would have come up in body shop, then I would have come back in body. So, but being that I was 81 seniority, then they populated the paint department. I went up there.
Well, you're talking about leveling off. Talk about some of the layoffs and the strikes, if you've been through any of those. Have you been through anything like that?
Well, I've been through I mean, the, because they used to, before they negotiated that we could, that we had those 2 weeks off, they would, if you could put your name on either a maintenance list or a sanitation lift to work the changeovers. So anytime that I could, I always worked. So most of the changeovers, I always worked them because I always wanted either the vacation time or I wanted that stuff back. But I remember when we used to clean ovens every year, and you would go up in there, and the paint was just caked on, from the fumes and stuff. And you would go up there, and they had like air chisels and stuff, and they had teams in each oven. And you would go through and you would clean up sealer off the floors and the paint and stuff off the walls. And then that first team would go through with the air chisels, and then another team would go through with brooms and dustpans, and then another team would go through with tack racks and tack it all off. And then once you got the whole oven done, which was, it seemed like they were a mile long, and it was hot in there too. Now, they shut the ovens off, of course, but it was in the middle of the summer. And so you would go through, and once you got all done, then they would take Vaseline or some kind of sticky material. They would put it on a car, and then they would keep running that car through to get all of the dust out, so that way they wouldn't have dirt in the paint when they started the line back up. But at any rate, in a couple of times I worked for maintenance, and the maintenance people are really, really good to work with. They're just, I believe, there's only been really a couple that, weren't really cordial, when you would work with them. And they liked the helpers, because we would get out all of the tools, and we would put them all on the truck and everything, and especially once you worked with a group of guys, if you worked really hard, they always wanted you back. And so it was once you got your foot in the door in maintenance, which you would get maintenance helpers pay, which was more than the sanitation pay, plus you would get to work 7 days a week, not just 5 days a week, and so like if you worked through the 4th of July, you would actually get triple time on the weekends, on those holidays. So, but at any rate, getting back there, Bob Green helped me build a locker. And at the time, I was working up in building 21-3, and you would get terrible reception. Being that I worked in the booth, I had a little TV because I liked to watch Jay Leno and what was the other show I watched? LAPD Blue or something like that. But anyways, and so in between the jobs, I would look at my TV set. Well, I got terrible reception, so I got the bright idea of going up to the roof and running an antenna wire down from 21-3. And so I said, well, I need a... and that involved walking up in the steel beams way up in, it was really high in the air a couple of times. I thought I wasn't going to make it. But anyways, I got one run all the way down there, and I put the antenna up on top of the roof and ran the antenna wire down. And then Bob says, well, you need a locker. Let's build you one. And so he, took me through the steps of how to get the metal on there, get it straight so that it sat nice and, perpendicular on the floor. And then he taught me how to make belt buckles and knives, and so I spent the rest of the changeover building belt buckles and taking engravers and engraving stuff on them, and I made like a mountain of belt buckles. I made like 4 or 5 knives, and it was really, I mean, I learned so much from the millwrights and the tinners that it was just, it was really good.
And but, that was... to avoid a layoff in what you call changeover, right? Now that tell us what changeover is, and then go into telling us if you really were laid off at all.
Right. Okay. Changeover basically is when they would change over to a new model, the next model year. When I hired in 81, the changeovers were like 3 or 4 months long, and that's what I would do to try and avoid. The layoff. Some people would want the layoff to spend time with their families, and at that time, I just didn't like the break in my pay. So I would just always, like I say, try and work those changeovers. Towards, it had to have been, 1989 or 90 when they started the rolling changeover where they would actually... the material people would follow that. There would be a 3-car gap in the line, and the material people were actually changing the stock on the line as the new car rolled through, because the body change wasn't that significant to where they had to change carriers and change the distance in the dogs and take the chains out of the conveyors and so on and so forth. So in the chain that I'm talking about in the dogs are the dog that hooks the cart, that pulls the cart down the line. So, all right, and what else did you want me to talk about?
Talk about if you ever were in a layoff. Were you ever affected by a layoff?
I believe there was only one, and that was the one in between 1983 and 1984 when I leveled off up into paint. And then I knew Eddie Holmes, and I'm trying to think of the name of the other supervisor. I knew those two guys real well because they came to my Bible study. And so that was the foot in the door. They said, "Do you want to work changeover?" I'm like, "Yeah." They're like, "Well, you're going to be cleaning ovens or, you know, booze, shoveling out the booze." I'm like, "That's fine." And so that's when I got my foot in the door, and I was able to, I worked pretty much every changeover all the way through until we started doing the mandatory two-week shutdowns.
How about strikes?
We had one strike in that I was actually a part of, and what I chose to do was walk the picket line over on Michigan Avenue over by the south lot. And again, that was just because I didn't want to have to drive in. I believe the pay that we were going to get for strike pay was going to be $60 a week, in between $60 and $100. I thought it was $100. And again, you know, we of course, talking before, we were trying to figure out who was the chairman. And I know that Ted Hartman was the president at that time because I was trying to get into the benefits field. And I learned who Ted Hartman was at that interview, because I sat down in front of him, and they said, well, I sat down at the end of the table, and there was a bunch of people around there, and they're like, "Do you know everybody here?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, I know Doug Taylor, I know Ken Mashad, and I went around, I named everybody." And Ted Hartman was sitting all the way to the other end. I said, "Well, I really don't have any idea who you are." You know, he was the union president, you know. So I'm like, "Well, I blew this interview, you know, and might as well kiss this job goodbye," you know. So, but, and that was just a part of, because there's always opportunity, talking about, I'll explain what an appointed position is. An appointed position is where it is basically an offline job where the union picks people who have specific gifts and talents, like, for instance, the chaplain's job, you know, the job that I'm in right now. You know, they would pick an ordained minister who had experience in that field, you know, because they wouldn't just take anybody and put them into an EAP. You know, they wouldn't take, you know, like I said, just anybody and put them into a position. Kind of like the photo editor that Linda Johnson is, you know, they wouldn't take a person who didn't know how to type. So they would, you put a resume in at the hall and actually put in for the job, and then the executive board or the president and the chairman would go over all of the best, and then resumes, and then they would pull those people in and interview them. And so that's what that interview was like. So, did that answer your question? Did I leave anything out?
Well, you threw in the acronym EAP. Would you explain what that is?
Yes, the EAP is the Employees Assistance Program. The Employee Assistance Program was started way back in the late 1970s, I believe, early 80s. And what it was is it was based in substance abuse. People who had substance abuse problems would come in into our office, and then they would find them help. And now it's called the Work Family Program, and we do everything from child care, elder care, referrals, which we would either give them a phone number to call or you know, find them help. For instance, an employee might come in and they might be having problems with a mom or a dad or a grandma or grandpa who's in Florida, and they're up here, and of course they can't leave here to go to Florida and to take care of them. And so as far as the elder care program, it's a 1-800 nationwide number, and you would call, they call that number and they say, "Well, my mom and dad are in Florida and I need to find them help." And so they would actually, you know, help them find it. Same child care, people working on the afternoon shift who were having problems finding a babysitter or something, the child care rep or ourselves would actually help them find licensed daycare for their shift in their area. And then, of course, we send people to a CDR, which is a central diagnostic and referral company for substance abuse and counseling. They do everything from financial counseling to marital counseling to substance abuse counseling, grief counseling, any kind of counseling that our members or the people in the plant, and that's for supervision and for hourly people, if they need help. Because a lot of times when people are on the line, they think in a circle, you know, just like they are putting the part on the car. And so, and that causes them to, you know, have anxiety and you know, problems with their job. So we're just there to assist them.
Doug, are you married?
Yes, I am. I've been married for 23 years. We have four biological children, a 15-year-old that we are going to adopt, and a 9-year-old that we're going to adopt.
Can you share the difficulty or what was it like for you to raise a family and work at General Motors about 30 miles away from your home? Or
With a lot of overtime. With a lot of overtime.
I've got a fantastic wife, you know, so, I mean, as far as raising the children, she's always taken the, I was just the enforcer, you know, if I come home, if mama wasn't happy, nobody was happy, somebody pays, you know, and that's just how it is. But, I mean, the hardest thing was working the second shift. I mean, that's the, what I had the hardest time with, because parent-teacher conferences, if we couldn't get in during the day, my wife would go herself. Watching baseball, soccer, stuff like that, that happens at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm already at work, you know, and you can't really take work off to go to your child's games. So I missed out on a lot of that stuff. The real important stuff I would be at. I would try and hit as many of them as I could, take vacation days and stuff. But as far as raising the family, you know, really, when you talk about working on the line and you talk about getting into other people's families and other people's lives, you tend to, you know, talk to the people about the problems that you're having. And so when you're talking about it, a lot of times, you know, you come up with pretty darn good ideas on how to handle certain situations, especially with the older people who have already raised children or the younger people who are trying to raise children. So, you know, you like potty training and stuff like that, you know, and I mean, teenage years, we all know, you know, the kids lose their brain. They have none, you know, it's all right, you know. So, but, you know, I've got four teenagers right now, and it's fun.
Did you drive in every day or did you carpool?
On and off, when I lived in Ithaca, I drove every day by myself. When I lived in Portland, I rode with Mike Gailey for a while, Matt Strickland for a while. I was in a carpool with, if I can remember everybody's names, Jerry Kramer. Jerry Kramer, Mike Gailey. There was five of us. Because we all rode in Mike's van. But anyways, Randy Peek. Who else was in that?
Well, did you pay money to one person? Did you just change vehicles or?
Yeah, once we got.
What was that commitment? What did it cost you?
Right. Once we got in, you know, once you found a group of people, if one guy had a van, normally you would pay him 10 to 15 bucks a week, and then they would just drive back and forth, and you never had to drive. When I just rode with two people, then we would just alternate back and forth, or three. You know, you'd alternate every third day you would drive. And because we all lived in the same community, we would just drive to those people's houses and pick them up, and then we would drop them off at night. You know, so.
So, what about Michigan winters? That quite an adventure.
Yeah.
And talk about your early days. What did you do before work, after work, your lunch times?
Well, do I really want to open up this can of worms? In the early days when I first hired in, I would, you know, we would smoke a joint, you know, maybe or two or three, and then, you know, drink a pint of whiskey or so, and then we would, you know, once I got my 90 days in, of course, and then at break, we would, of course, run out to our cars and, you know, or just hop outside and we'd smoke a joint or two. And in one particular time, there was probably, I'm not going to name any names, but there was probably, oh gosh, there had to have been six people standing in a circle right by the door where you walked in. And we were standing there smoking a joint. And it was going around, and it came around to a particular young man. And the guard comes walking through the door, and he looks at us, and he's like, "Are you guys smoking a joint?" And the man who had it says, "Yeah." And he just kind of laughed it off and walked away like we weren't serious. You know, we were there, you know, and but anyways, you know, and then of course every lunch we would either run over to Harry's or the Shop Stop, or, you know, if we were if we had a long lunch, if the line was down, we would go to the pub or the Irish pub or the Dispatch, because on Thursday nights they have their steaks, and you know, pretty much whoever was having the food deal at that time. So in Gus's, of course, Gus's bar, at that particular point in time, we would call over to the bar, and he would set up probably six or eight Amaretto or tequila slammers, and we would go over there and pound them on the table and drink our slammers down, run to the car, smoke a joint, and then run all the way back up to 21-3. So
at the end of work, huh? Now making that trip, did you guys plan payday? Did you plan adventures?
Yeah, we did. And I suppose you want me to tell you about some of the adventures. No, at Thursday night's pay night, of course you go over to the bar, you cash your check at lunch, and then we would go over to the Union Hall parking lot, and you would just go over there, and everybody, you know, turn their radios on the same station, or if, you know, you'd have, you know, maybe the rappers over here, rock and roll over here, and country and western over here, and everybody would just kind of congregate around those cars, and we would just stand there and drink, and, you know.
Doug, you say everybody. Can you share how many people would show up at this after-work gathering?
Do you really want me to tell you that number, Doug?
You know, I guess.
Some nights, you know, it wasn't. Some nights it got pretty crazy. I mean, there were, you know, the lot was full, and other nights it wasn't so full. You know, it would all really depend on who all made plans to go over there. You know, there was...
What's a lot? How many people?
Was this a
give me a number?
Thing?
I don't know how big this parking lot is.
Okay. You want a number of people? There was, on a busy night, there had to have been, I don't know, 60 to 100 people over there, maybe more. You know, somewhere in there.
Was
know.
This a paint department thing?
No, I wouldn't say just paint, because there was people. You know, when I worked in trim, I would go over there. So I mean, it would be paint, trim, and body. Okay. You know, all together. And then, you know, of course, at different starting times, everybody would just kind of funnel through, as, you know, body would get out first, and body shop would go over there, and then the trim people would, or the paint people would go over there, and then the trim people would, you know, so it was just, you know.
So you say the Union Hall was the hall open?
No, the hall wasn't open itself. You know, the executive board wasn't there, just the, I call it the cage, you know, the cage was open, so you could go in there and you know, you know, throw shoes up in the tree, or, you know, whatever you...
Cage being the fenced-in part.
Cage would be the fenced-in part around the hall to protect it from the riffraff in the area.
So was that okay? I mean, the police didn't mind you in there having
a party? The police would show up from time to time, and, you know, if it got to be, you know, 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, the music was up too loud, yes, the police would show up and kind of disperse the crowd, so to speak.
Were there just Plant folks, or were there some community folks there also?
Pretty much it was mostly plant folk. I would say probably 99% of them were Plant folk. Every now and then you'd have, you know, maybe a spouse or somebody drive in looking for their... No, I'm just teasing.
No, you're not.
I mean, I'm sure it happened, you know, looking for their spouse and the paycheck, you know, but... It was, you know, a couple of times it you know, got out of control a little bit, but, you know, the police would show up accordingly and, like I said, disperse us, so.
Doug, seeing how you've live the life, and you're certainly leading by example now. Talk about some of the outreach programs that you do as a chaplain, such as the prisons, the sick and shut-ins, the funerals that you attend, the things that you do that we don't see you do. Can you talk about some of those things, please?
Sure. You know, my job as a chaplain ranges, it's a pretty far range. We, of course, do weddings and funerals and baptisms, but it's not really about Christian faith. It's more about, it's like a ministry of compassion. If somebody needs us, of course, we go. Myself and in the committee, I've got a committee, three other ordained ministers that that helped me do the ministerial stuff, Kirkland Hall, Reverend Kirkland Hall, Reverend Eugene Murchison, and Reverend Walt Saxton, and myself are all ordained, and we do the weddings and the funerals, the licensed part of the ministry, and then I've got Craig Johnson, Dave Brown, Martha Adams, Fred Powell, Cheryl Vaughn, and those people do the lay ministries like the hospital visits, sending cards, sympathy cards, get well cards, and it's like a network that, you know, we have people from body shop, paint, and trim that are all on the chaplaincy, and when they hear of people that are maybe sick, you know, they have a loved one die, pass away, then they get a hold of me, or they go themselves and see the people. As far as prison ministry, unfortunately, we do have members that are housed with the state of Michigan, and they range from all the way down by Adrian to all the way up to Marquette in the Upper Peninsula. And I don't go up to Marquette on a real regular basis, but when I do go to Black Lake for like the chaplaincy conferences or the EAP conferences, they normally give us a Wednesday afternoon, and on that Wednesday afternoon, so I'm up there like twice a year, and I go up and I visit people who are in Marquette Prison or the Hiawatha State Prison, all the way down to Jackson, Adrian, Pontiac, all over the place, and then up on top of all of that, we do people who are in inpatient, like detox units, and you know, they're in the program, so to speak. The program being the they go to AANACAMA, and they're inpatient. We will travel to the hospitals in Grand Rapids, well, wherever they are, you know, Grand Rapids. Go ahead.
Tell us what AANA and what was the other one?
CA and MA. Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Marijuana Anonymous, and Narcotics Anonymous.
Okay.
So all of those. And then basically in the plant, we try and be as visible as we possibly can. And, you know, if people need us, we can go out there on the floor or come. If they want it to be a very confidential thing, then we have them come down to the office and we talk to them. It's all confidential. We don't tell anybody anything about anybody's life. You know, it's all as far as that goes. Let me see. What else do I do?
Community organizations?
Yes. Let me step back here a little bit. If people are trying to get their driver's licenses back, most people who are in the program, I will write letters of recommendation if I know about their program, and write them a letter of recommendation, letting them know that, you know, of course, I know them and I know what kind of a program that they're running and stuff like that. Now, moving forward, what was that question?
Community organizations.
I work on the critical and stress management team, which we call it the CISM, Critical Incident Stress Management. And what we do is we work in the Tri-County area, Eaton, Ingham, and Clinton counties, and we go around and do debriefings. What a debriefing or a diffusing is for the fire department and the police department. When they go up to a tragic accident or a scene, they have, you know, they get that picture in their mind, and if they're having trouble sleeping at night or they're getting irritable or, you know, whatever the case may be, then they get the whole team together as a team, And we, and I say we have people from Community Mental Health. Doug Patrick, who is in management here, is also on the team with us. I don't know all the names of the people in there, but there's probably a team of like 25 people. And we go in, we sit down with them, and we just ask specific questions and go through like a format that helps them debrief, you know, seeing that, you know, they did this and it was all a part of the big picture. And I also am in the AFL-CIO Church Community Labor Alliance, and we do different things. Paula, what is Paula?
Silas.
Huh?
Simon.
Simon, yeah. I wanted to say Smith for some reason. I work with her and some of the other ministers in the community, and we are out there trying to make a difference in the community. One church, one pastor, one school. There's all different kinds of stuff that we do there. I'm trying to think what else we do.
Well, while you're thinking of that, Doug, is there, back to Fisher Body, I know you can't share names, but is there a particular scenario or event that you had a major impact on that's impacted your life, or a memory of the most rewarding thing you've done through your ministry work?
Well, we had two people who had died in the plant. And in one person was up in paint, and the other person was down here in engineering. And doing the critical incident stress management for that, and seeing, really just when you talk about death and dying and people suffering loss, especially in the workplace, when you've worked with a person for years and they pass away. And just helping the people see that, you know, no matter what, you know, no matter if in the perfect incident, they probably wouldn't have been able to save the person's life if they had a massive coronary or, you know, they had something major happen. Helping them get from that step to a place of, okay, acceptance. Because really, in my eyes, you never really get closure when you're dealing with the loss of a loved one. You will always remember that person. There'll always be a memory in your mind of the smiles that they gave you, or the, you know, the stuff that they would bring in, or the jokes that they would tell, or, you know, the time that they helped you in their personal life. So, in essence, you never really get closure. What we try and work them to is acceptance, that they did the best that they could at that particular point in time. I think those situations, or visiting the funeral homes, those are the times when, you know, you see people really at the most critical times of their lives, you know. And hospital visits are good, but really the funeral homes, going there and seeing people when they experience loss and they're hurting, and knowing that you care. You know, that you care enough to come and see them, you know, and help them. Go ahead.
I had a question. Tell me a little bit about the changes that happened within the culture of Fisher Body from the time when you first started, because you talked about that in the partying atmosphere and things like that, to how did you get to where you are today? What happened with the transition? Was that something that happened culturally within the plant, or was that more of a personal issue? Because I know for myself that I noticed a lot of the different transitions between people.
Right. Really, you know, when I was working with Rich and Brent, Roy, and there was just a you know, the group of guys, and we were eating. Those guys, even though that they knew that I was smoking cigarettes and smoking pot and drinking and stuff, they just loved on me. They just accepted me for who I was. They didn't look at the, and I'll call them bad points of who Doug was, because Doug was really rough around the edges. I cussed and swore and everything. But, you know, You know, Rich had said to me one time, you know, Doug, I'd sit next to you in church. I wouldn't have a problem with that, you know. And so I went to his church, you know, and he just accepted me right where I was at. He didn't, you know, rub in my face that I was this, you know, this sinner person that had to do a lot of changing. He just really just showed me Christ. And, you know, I started looking at my life versus their lives. And, you know, Rich could buy a car for $50 and sell it for $500, and I'd buy one for $1,500 and sell it for $50. You know, I mean, everything, you know. And he would talk about his wife and how happy they were, you know, being married, and he'd talk about their kids and playing wiffle ball, and, you know, he'd talk about his in-laws and his mom and dad, and, you know, he just everything really that I want, I was just naturally gravitating towards that part of my life. You know, do I want to, you know, keep using drugs and using and have my, you know, life, not that my life was all terrible, because my life really wasn't, you know, but I just knew that there was something more that I was reaching for. You know, I wanted that place of peace to where I didn't have to spend, you know, $40 on a bag of pot in order to get peace, or drink a pint of whiskey in order to get that, you know, I'm finally here, you know, type of feeling. And so I had, you know, I had worked with Rich for, I don't know, probably a good, it was probably a year or so. And I just decided that there was a change that needed to be made. And so I just, it slowly gravitated from me going out at lunch every day and hanging with the group that I was hanging with at the bar to, you know, now I'm involved in, we had lunch every day, you know, naturally talk about biblical things. They would bless the food. And, you know, being raised a Catholic, I knew quite a lot about the Bible. You know, surprisingly enough, I could really hold my own. You know, I mean, I knew who Abraham and Moses and, you know, I knew who, you know, Joshua and all the people of the Old Testament and Paul and, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and, you know, Bartimaeus and all those guys. I knew who they were because I had been raised around that. You know, so it was just an easy transition for me to make.
I just want to know, was the program you speak of, the employee assistant program, was there something like that available to you, or was it there, or was it not there back then, and that's why you embraced it now?
I think it was there, but I don't think it was that well known or trusted in at that point. I think it was more for the substance abuse arena, and you know, really, people who use don't really want to admit that they have a problem. You know, you're the last person to know that you have a problem, you know, until you actually try and quit. You know, and then all of a sudden, hey, wait a minute here, you know, something is missing. You know, but you know, as far as the employees' assistance, you know, program goes, you know, all three of us that work in the office, Martha Adams, Nadine Reynolds, and myself, we work very hard to try and keep a very confidential program. We try and get out in, not only in the plant, but in the community to help people, you know, that we know that are in need.
Doug, yeah. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I think one of the largest masses that I saw the EAPs participate in was when they had the death up in 3X with the construction worker. Were you part of the team at that time?
No, I wasn't. No, but Nadine and Martha were. And like I say, you know, I've taken place in a couple of the critical incidences when people have died here in the plant and really affected the co-workers. You know, they might feel at fault.
Yeah. That was the largest... that particular incident, because I was a part of that one. Mm-hmm. I didn't remember whether or not you were there, but there was a large group of people that were affected by that particular incident. And so your group that you belong to, it's a good
yes,
group.
Yep, they were up there. Yeah.
Doug, would you talk about your union?
Yeah, our union right now, I'm very proud of the executive board, our president, our chairman. They have huge hearts, more so, and I can't say it's more so than any other president and chairman, but I will, because, you know, how do I want to put this? I think that they genuinely care about each and every person that's in our local. I think they really listen to the people. I think they work very, very hard. They really pour themselves in their lives. They spend a lot of time working, not only here in the shop, but out in the community. And I think it's a pretty big sacrifice that they make, you know, trying to, you know, take care of everybody's needs. And again, you're not going to be able to make everybody happy, you know, because you'll make one decision and, you know, a group of people will yell about that, and you'll make another decision and a whole different group will yell about that, you know. So, you know, from what I've seen, I think our union really helps us, not only in the negotiation part, but being there to protect us. As far as, like I said, not negotiations, but as far as being in the workplace, you get a big variety of foremen, some who care, some who don't, you know, some who are, you know, really genuinely care about the product that are getting out, and some who are climbing the ladder, you know, trying to get to a higher position, and they'll burn anybody that they can. And I think our local union, the UAW Local 602, has a very good safety net. Not only the online committee men, I call them online, but the people who take the committee calls, but the districts, the zones, like I said, the whole executive board. I think they just have huge hearts. So,
outside of chaplaincy and being the EAP, are there any other union functions or committees that you sit in or have sit in the past?
The Black History Program, the CAP.
What is CAP?
Capital
Community Action Program.
Thank you. I just thought it's CAP. Community is a what?
Community Action Program.
Yes, Community Action Program. All right, now I lost my train of thought. Where was I? Flashback.
Which is also legislative arm. But we were talking about the different committees that you've participated in, along with being a chaplain.
Right. Well, every year, you know, the chaplaincy tries to team up with as many of the standing committees as we can to get food baskets for Christmas time. We try to get at least 5 or 6 food baskets up and around, which has all different kinds of goods in them, maybe hats, gloves, toilet paper, paper towels, the Adopt-A-Family programs. I'm just trying to think here.
You do have an abundance of things.
Yeah, right. We try and be as involved as we possibly can. If anybody has an invocation or a benediction that they would like done for any committee, we're honored to do those for them. Any kind of, we try and work hand in hand with Mike Clark's committee. What is that? The
Community Service.
The Community Service, where they had Miss Martha and Mike Clark really did a fantastic job of stepping up to the plate for the people who were being down from New Orleans, the
Katrina
hurricane. And of course, they had called me, and by the time I had gotten my kids taken care of, I showed up. And I was there. So, but they had already had, you know, we have such just hard-working, generous people at our local, hard-working, dedicated to making sure not only the UAW Local 602, but the people in the community are taken care of.
I want to go back and talk about benefits very briefly and what the benefits you have received from UAW and General Motors. You know, talk about your schooling that it takes for you to do what you do as an EAP, the schooling that you had to have to be a chaplain, and the training. And you also spoke about Black Lake. What is Black Lake?
Okay. Starting at the beginning, when I felt a call on my life, I did the tuition assistance program, and I went to Bible college at Lansing Mount Hope Bible Training Institute. I was in that Bible college for 4 years before I had gotten, it wasn't a degree, it was a certification to be licensed. And then at that point, I joined the World Harvesters Ministers Network out of South Bend, Indiana, Lester Summerall's church. And they are the ones who helped me walk towards my ordination. The TAP program is the tuition assistance program. And basically what they do is they pay for your classes in a specific field or personal enrichment. And you fill out a form or get on the internet and you apply for this. And as long as you get a C or better, they pay for that class. Going into Black Lake, in order to be an employee's assistance representative, you have to take the basic training, which consists of learning how to listen, learning how to parrot people back, learning comforting words, learning how to pick emotions out of what the people are going through, because a lot of time, if a person is angry, it's just a fruit of a tree that has a root. If they have a substance abuse problem, it's a fruit on a tree that has a root. And so what you're going after is the root of the tree, so that you can help them work through their problem or get them into counseling, professional counseling. Black Lake is basically the Walter Reuther. Go ahead, help me out, Doug.
Walter and May Reuther Educational Center.
Thank you. Yes, that's what it is. And it's a very, very beautiful, rustic place where you go, where we go for our training. And they have classrooms, gymnasium, swimming pool, workout center, a lot of rooms, very nice rooms. And you go up there and they have classes for a week long. And you go through these classes, and again, they teach you really how to do your job, how to be effective on your job. And so you spend a week up there, and once a year, and that keeps you up to breast on the changes in the work family internationally, and the stuff to bring back so that locally you can help people better.
Wrapping up here, I wanted to touch base on what are your personal feelings of the plant closing, and how does that, you know, affect you?
Well, of course, being that I've worked here for 23 years, it's been a huge part of my life. Not driving down Saginaw or down Michigan Avenue and seeing, you know, and knowing that I'm coming to this big green building, you know, because ever since I hired in here, they've been telling me, you know, when I first hired in, you're never going to make it 90 days. Oh, you're never going to make it to your 5 years. Oh, you're never going to make it to 10 years. Oh, you're never going to make it to 15 years. Well, 23 and a half years later, here I sit, you know, still working, you know, only being, you know, really having to take a layoff one or two times. You know, the people, it's not really about the building in itself. It's more about knowing that I'm going to the new plant with all of the people that I've known for this many years is really a blessing in my heart. Will I miss the building? No, it's dirty. It's old. It's falling apart. It leaks. The body shop floods when it rains. No, I really won't miss the building. It would really break my heart for them to say, well, we're closing you down and all of you people are going to be GM gypsies and dispersed all over the place. That would in itself devastate me. Because, you know, you can't work someplace 20 years and all of the relationships that have been built in, you know, knowing other people's families and, you know, seeing them go from seeing them have children and now their children are in college and, you know, they're going from college to they're having babies themselves and, you know, and now they're grandparents and seeing those changes in life are just, it's just a huge, huge blessing. You know, to be able to be a part of as many people's lives is what we are.
Doug, thank you for sharing.
Not a problem.
Thank you very much.
Great being here.
Thanks, Tish.